The headlines. Brazilians cast their votes in the first round of a polarized presidential election, with the leftist Lula da Silva expected to beat right-wing incumbent Jair Bolsonaro. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says the key town of Lyman in the eastern Donetsk region is now fully cleared of Russian forces. And Iran holds a funeral for the security forces killed during a terrorist attack in the southeastern city of Zahedan. Thanks for joining us. Brazil, people in Brazil are heading to the polls in one of the country's most divisive presidential elections in decades. Voting is compulsory for over 156 million eligible Brazilians. 11 candidates are on the ballot, but the main contenders are far-right incumbent Jair Bolsonaro and the leftist former president Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva. Campaigning has been bitter, with the two candidates exchanging insults. Opinion polls show Lula has a double-digit lead over Bolsonaro, putting him on course for an outright first-round victory. Upon casting his ballot, Lula said that he is running for president to bring the country back to normal and to establish peace. Bolsonaro, meanwhile, expressed confidence that he would win, saying clean elections have to be respected. Our correspondent in Sao Paulo, Camila Escalante, joined us earlier with more details on the presidential election in Brazil.
Surveys of voter intention, one by IPEC and one by Datafolha, and both showed Lula with about 50 to 51% of valid votes. What he needs is 50% plus one, and it maintained that Bolsonaro has about 35 to 30% of voter intention. That means that there's a high possibility, and we're within the margin of error, for Lula to win in the first round. It seems like there's a lot of momentum on his side right now, judging from the final rallies. We've seen massive rallies in these last few days in Salvador, in Fortaleza, and here in Sao Paulo. And he's supported not only by the left wing, but a large part of the center and even the bourgeoisie in this country is split about this. He's received some support from sectors that traditionally might support the right wing. So we're thinking that, you know, that it might actually be a sweep for him this first round, but it's difficult to say given that he's right at 50% right now, according to those two voter intention surveys.
The Ukrainian president says the key town of Lyman in the eastern Donetsk region is now fully cleared of Russian forces. Volodymyr Zelensky has made the announcement in a short video clip on his Telegram channel. Just a day earlier, Russia said it was withdrawing its troops from their months-long stronghold in the north of Donetsk region. President Vladimir Putin days ago officially declared the annexation of four Ukrainian regions to Russia. He said people in Donetsk, Kherson, Zaporizhia, and Luhansk will remain Russian citizens forever. Moscow says people in the four regions have voted overwhelmingly to join the Russian Federation in referendums held last week. But Ukraine and its Western allies have called the votes illegal and a sham. From Donetsk, our correspondent Johnny Miller joined us earlier for more details on recent Ukrainian advances.
The Ukrainian army has, it looks like, captured Lyman. Now, Lyman is a strategically important place in Donetsk. The Russians certainly put up a major fight over the last few days in order to try and keep hold of it. I have seen many videos posted by Ukrainians on their Telegram channels of dead Russian soldiers and captured Russian soldiers, some of whom are being mistreated. Of course, this is part of a wider offensive by the Ukrainians started a few weeks ago, in which they did take back large areas of the Kharkov region. Russia didn't really fight for those regions, but what's different about Lyman is that Russia really did try to hold on to the town. Ukraine has also been trying to take Kherson with not much success in the south. So this is a major victory, at least in the short term, by the Ukrainians. However, it's still difficult to see whether Ukraine is going to be able to advance much further. We'll see in the coming days and weeks whether they are able to. But of course, Russia has just mobilized 300,000 men. It will take some weeks for many of those soldiers to get to the front line. So Russia will be hoping they're able to get here to Donbass before Ukraine is able to make any more advances. But it's still unclear whether Ukraine, its aim is to take back these four regions. It's still difficult to see whether they'll be able to make too much more advances. We'll have to wait and see on that.
The Nord Stream 2 pipeline is no longer leaking natural gas, but questions remain over the act of sabotage and who was behind it. This was a deliberate attempt at shutting off gas to Europe. But who's guilty? Russia, who has been accused of using energy as a weapon, allegedly? Or the U.S., whose president once said if Russia carries through with this special military operation, the Nord Stream pipeline would not be operational?
When it comes to the Nord Stream pipeline sabotage, a fourth leak has been found. That was enough for a Security Council meeting to take place. But at the end of the session, Russia was blamed for the act of sabotage. Russia and the West are trading blame over this. Although Russia has not accused the US by name, all of its statements are pointing the finger at the US. The same goes for the US and the EU. Both have stopped short of directly accusing Russia. Russia has said that the US president is obliged to answer the question of whether the US carried out its threat.
If Russia invades, that means tanks or troops crossing the border of Ukraine again, then there will be no longer a Nord Stream 2. We will bring an end to it.
How will you do that exactly, since the project and control of the project is within Germany's control?
We will, I promise you, we'll be able to do it.
Meanwhile, Washington also dismissed the suggestion and accused Russia of spreading disinformation. While the EU has said the sabotage was deliberate, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said it would be in no one's interest if the leaks were caused deliberately. But Blinken's point that it would be in no one's interest can be argued otherwise. In the case of the U.S., it would reap huge benefits. For example, it would continue selling gas to the EU and make huge profits. Some single shipments are bringing in $200 million U.S. for the U.S. The U.S. is now sending 60% of its liquefied natural gas exports to Europe, up from less than 20% this time a year ago. Meanwhile, the high gas and electricity prices are pushing European manufacturers to shift to the U.S. This is because there are relatively stable prices in there, with green energy incentives also luring the companies to the U.S. The U.S.'s recently adopted Inflation Reduction Act makes it a particularly attractive destination for companies in the chemicals, batteries, and green energy sectors. It aims to increase manufacturing and level the international playing field by using American incentives to match the competition from overseas. But what about the other parties that are related to Russia's Nord Stream pipeline, namely Russia and the EU? Would either benefit from the act of sabotage on the pipeline? The answer is a resounding no in the case of the EU. In Europe, more and more companies are switching into survival mode. For a lot of them, the time is coming to renew their electricity supply contracts with utilities. And thanks to the energy inflation, these are set to be much higher than the contracts for the current year. Meanwhile, the European Commission has promised to help by capping the revenues of oil, gas, and coal companies. As for Russia, it would lose income, so that would also be ruled out. Russia has said that Europe is now indefinitely deprived of key gas supply routes. It said that it is searching for ways to get the pipelines up and running, but the timeline cannot yet be estimated. So the big winner from the energy crisis in Europe would be the US.
The Nord Stream sabotage has triggered a new crisis between the West and Russia. But in this scenario, the U.S. has the most to gain out of the crisis. You see, while trying to demonize Russia, it's reaping the benefits of gas sales, as an example. while European companies consider or are actively relocating to the U.S. More importantly, once European factories and firms go through this relocation, the U.S. can then be assured that Europe is on its side in its confrontation with China.
Europe's descent into deindustrialization is happening at warp speed. With the sabotage of the Nord Stream pipeline, there is no way back. Europe can no longer import Russian gas, and this means that prices will remain high until Europe builds more energy capacity, and this could take years. High energy prices will, in essence, make European manufacturing uncompetitive. After all, European manufacturers will be forced to pass the higher energy cost to the end user or the consumers. And that is how many European businesses will begin to unravel. According to one analyst, the only logical European response to the threat of widespread deindustrialization is to raise tariffs. This is the only way to balance out prices between more expensive European goods and cheaper foreign goods. One of the consequences, however, is that it will lower living standards, depriving Europeans of cheaper priced goods. In short, this no longer looks like a short-term crisis for Europe. Stories from Europe are like stories once heard in countries that are suffering from high inflation, and resource rations imposed by the state. European companies or factories moving to the US would help the US economic situation. The US is already suffering from high inflation and an energy crunch. The relocation of European manufacturers to the United States will give the US a big advantage by boosting investment and creating jobs. It will also strengthen the country's industrial economy. This will also give the United States a bigger advantage in the face of its increasing military and economic confrontation with China. And in the face of rising competition with Russia and China, having Europe on its side will prove to be a big advantage for the United States. The question is whether the Biden administration knowingly nudged Europe to decouple from Russian energy sources in order to lure European companies toward the influence sphere of Washington.
A funeral procession has been held for the Iranian security forces who were killed during a terrorist attack in the southeastern Sistan and Balochistan province. Senior local and military officials attended the ceremony in the provincial capital, Zahedan. On Friday, members of a separatist group staged an armed attack on a police station and vandalized public property in Zahedan. They opened fire on security forces as well as worshippers who were in the area following Friday prayers. Security forces moved in quickly to repel the attack. Provincial officials initially said 19 people had been killed in the violence. The ground force of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps in the southeast says 5 security forces lost their lives. Academic and political analyst Alexander Azadgan says he believes the Saudi government was behind the recent deadly terror attack in southeastern Iran.
It's very important for Iranian officials at the highest level to visit Sistan and Balochistan province to send a solid symbolic message to Saudi Arabia. You ask me who's behind this, and it's Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is the second state sponsor of terror around the world. They support terrorist groups, whether it's ISIS, ISIS-K, or Al-Qaeda, or all these other groups. There's one in Algeria that doesn't, in Nigeria that doesn't come to my mind, Boko Haram. And this is what they're doing right now. They are taking advantage of the anti-hijab media momentum when Iran itself has stretched itself thin in different fronts. And let's not forget, there are several fronts with this. Obviously, they attack Sistan, Balochistan, and specifically Zahedan. Saudi Arabia not only supports this financially, but Saudi Arabia funds an anti-Iran propaganda channel out of London. Obviously, I'm not going to call the, you know, mention their name. Let's just call them the voice of Saudi Arabia, because that's what they do.
Iran's president has blamed the Western media hype over the recent unrest in the country. He says that enemies have failed in their new plots to hinder the country's progress. Ebrahim Raisi says the enemies launched a campaign to isolate Iran at a time when it was prevailing over economic problems and becoming more active on the regional and international stage. Earlier, the chief commander of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps also vowed a crushing response to, quote, destructive U.S., U.K., and Saudi media campaigns against Iran. Major General Hossein Salami said Iran's enemies launched the political and media campaign to make up for the U.S. decline. He also said they don't want to allow the existence of a powerful, influential, and sovereign country ruled by Islam. The death toll from a stampede and riot in an Indonesian football stadium has risen to 125. Scores of others have also been injured. The tragedy unfolded when supporters of the losing side rushed to the pitch in anger. Indonesian security forces fired tear gas to push the rioters back. But that triggered panic and a deadly stampede as fans tried to escape. The government of President Joko Widodo has called the incident a tragedy, apologizing to the public. Widodo has also ordered a security review. This is the deadliest stadium tragedy since the 1964 riot and crush in Peru that killed nearly 330 people. To the United States, where the confirmed death toll from Hurricane Ian has risen to at least 44. Authorities say the final death toll will be much higher, as reports of additional fatalities are still emerging from different counties in the state of Florida. The devastating storm has left behind a trail of destruction in Florida, with rescuers still searching for survivors in submerged neighborhoods and along the state's southwest coast. Homes, restaurants, and businesses were ripped apart when Ian roared ashore as a powerful Category 4 hurricane on Wednesday. U.S. media have tallied more than 70 deaths related to the storm, directly or indirectly. President Joe Biden will head to Puerto Rico and Florida this week to get a first-hand look at the damage caused by back-to-back hurricanes. And that does it for World News.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The Ocean of Dua.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program, The Ocean of Dua. In this edition of the program, we'll have a glance at Kumail's supplication and we'll discuss a commentary on that. We'll be back in a few seconds, so stay tuned. يا إلهي وربي وسيدي ومولاي لأي الأمور إليك أشكو ولما منها أضج وأبكي لأليم العذاب وشدته Dear listeners, we have reached this part of the supplication of Kumail. Ya ilahi wa rabbi wa sayyidi wa mawlai. My Lord, my Master and my Protector. Li ayyil umur ilayka ashku wa lima minha adijju wa abki.
For which things would I complain to you? And for which of them would I lament and weep? لِأَلِيمِ الْعَذَابِ وَشِدَّتِهِ For the pain and severity of the chastisement, أَمْ لِطُولِ الْبَلَاءِ وَمُدَّتِهِ Or for the length and period of the tribulations. So, what we explained so far is that the commander of the lovers in this part of the supplication is trying to tell us that there is only one that we can refer to for our complaints. There is only one that we have to weep and lament to. And this weeping and lamenting is one of His gifts. These are Almighty Allah's gifts for the servants, and these are the things that show the humbleness of the heart. The Holy Prophet ﷺ says, مَنْ خَرَجَ مِنْ عَيْنِهِ مِثْلُ الذُّبَابِ مِنَ الدَّمْعِ مِنْ خَشْيَةِ اللَّهِ The one whose eyes weep from Allah's fear as a small as a mosquito, آمَنَهُ اللَّهُ بِهِ يَوْمَ الْفَزَعِ الْأَكْبَرِ Allah will save him just for that small teardrop from the hereafter. Prophet says, such man will be saved from hereafter just because of that weeping as small as a mosquito. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the commander of the believers, has also stated, بُكَاءُ الْعُيُونَ وَخَشْيَةُ الْقُلُوبِ رَحْمَةِ اللَّهِ تَعَالَى The weeping of the eyes and fear of the hearts are Allah's mercy. فَإِذَا وَجَدْتُمُهَا فَاغْتَنِمُ الدُّعَاءِ So if you found them, seize the chance to pray. This is because a prayer along with weeping and fear will be accepted. And one of the prerequisites of the acceptance of dua, and one of the signs of acceptance, is this weeping. And this is so important. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam has also said, مَا مِن شَيْءٍ إِلَّا وَلَهُ كَيْلٌ وَوَزْنٌ Everything has a special scale, except tears, إِلَّا الدُّمُوعُ فَإِنَّ الْقَطْرَةَ تُطْفِئُ بِحَارًا مِنَ النَّارِ Because a drop of fear can put off oceans of fire. وَلَوْ أَنَّ بَاكِيًا بَكَى فِي أُمَّةٍ لَرُحِمُ In fact, if there is one tearful person from Allah's fear in any nation, all those people will be forgiven because of that tearful person.
Oh my God, my Lord, my King and Master, Which of the matters shall I complain to you? And for which of them shall I wail and weep? Shall I wail for the pains of the punishment and its intensity? Or for the length of my suffering and its duration?
Thank you, Allah, let me hear, feeling so good about all. It's not a dream, this is so true. And we know we'll be here forever. The feeling is indescribable. Knowing that this is our reward.
The ocean of dua.
So, dear listeners, in this part, the supplicant is weeping from the chastisements. And at the same time asking the Lord of the worlds to save him. This weeping is a mercy from the side of the Almighty Allah and is a sign of the heart which is being softened. It's a sign of humiliation. And this is what we have been recommended to do, better say to have, when we are about to supplicate. If a supplicant wishes his prayer to be accepted, he must seek that kind of riqqatul qalb from the Almighty Allah. He must try to soften his heart, because when the heart becomes tender, only in such a time it will open up. In such time, the veils between the supplicant and Allah are lifted. And this way, the supplicant is closer to Almighty Allah. He is closer and nearer to Allah's mercy. In fact, this weeping, this lamenting, this sign of riqqatul qalb is so important that we have been recommended in our traditions to hold specific modes of prayer when we are supplicating. There are some narrations that put emphasis on self-abasement and tadalluh during prayer. And they are all for the purpose of actualizing this end. We have been ordered and recommended to ask from the Almighty Allah while we are invoking Him, just like a beggar is asking for food. And let me tell you this, that it is reported that among the things Allah, the Exalted, has revealed to Prophet Musa ala nabina wa alihi wa alayhi salam was this: O Musa, stretch your hands before me in humility, like a humble servant calling his master for help. If you did that, you will be showered with mercy, as I am the most kind of those who are kind and powerful. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode of the program as well. We ask the Almighty Allah to sit us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
In the limelight.
Physicians for Human Rights have recently announced that, according to its calculations, the number of children denied treatment outside Gaza had nearly doubled. This number includes children younger than one. Please stay with us for an article in this regard written by Feda Al-Ghidra journalist. This article is published under the heading Spike in Children Denied Medical Treatment by Zionist Regime's Military. Here's more. His health is deteriorating daily. Now, Saeed Dargun, 14, can't walk. Saeed from the city of Khan Yunis in the southern Gaza Strip has a cancerous tumor in his right leg. His condition is worsening because the Zionist regime occupation authorities are preventing him from traveling to the occupied territories for treatment. He is not the only one. Physicians for Human Rights has recently announced that, according to its calculations, the number of children denied treatment outside Gaza had nearly doubled. This number includes children younger than one. In September last year, Saeed underwent tests and PET and CT scans in an Egyptian hospital, after which doctors decided to transfer him to the occupied territories. The tumor in his right leg, which was first diagnosed in 2016, requires advanced medical treatment that is not available in Palestinian hospitals. Nahla, 28, Saeed's sister, told the Electronic Intifada that while Saeed was granted an all-hospitals appointment issued by both Zionist regime hospitals and those in the occupied West Bank, the delay in getting a travel permit to leave Gaza means that has now expired. We live in fear of his health. It's hard to see someone suffer all the time and you can't help him, Nahla said, adding, we just want to know the reason for rejection. As for Saeed, he's getting bored. I just hope to get treatment quickly so that I can walk and play with my friends, the teenager said, adding, I get bored sitting at home all the time, especially since there is no electricity or any means of entertainment in Gaza. Due to the Zionist regime restrictions on the import of fuel, Gaza suffers frequent electricity cuts. Saeed is not the only child who is awaiting the Zionist regime's approval to travel for treatment, whether to the occupied territories or to the West Bank. Physicians for Human Rights recently found that the number of children denied treatment had nearly doubled. According to the organization, in 2020, 17% of children's requests to leave the Gaza Strip for the purpose of receiving medical care not available in the Gaza Strip were delayed or refused. In the first 6 months of 2021, this rate had nearly doubled to 32%, according to calculations made by Physicians for Human Rights. According to the World Health Organization, more than 155 out of a total of 481 Palestinians under the age of 18 seeking to cross the Erez checkpoint for treatment in July this year were either refused or delayed. Among 0 to 3-year-olds, 30 children of 136 were rejected or delayed in seeking treatment. Such obstructions can prove fatal. Three children have died so far this year after permits to leave Gaza for medical treatment were denied or delayed, the human rights group Al-Mizan has reported. Enshirah Madani, 16, who has a malignant brain tumor, is also waiting for the Zionist regime permission to travel for treatment. Enshirah's mother told the Electronic Intifada that the delay in her daughter's treatment caused her to lose one eye as a result of the growth of the tumor. For years, the Zionist regime has been delaying, the mother said. I'm in so much pain while my daughter is slowly dying and I can do nothing for her, she said. Abdurrahman Abu Mustafa is less than a year old. He has lived with heart disease since he was born but needs open heart surgery, not available in the Gaza Strip. Gaza's health sector is in serious disarray as a direct result of the Zionist regime's 15-year blockade and its tight restrictions on people and goods entering and leaving the coastal strip of land. There is a chronic shortage of essential medicines and import bans block vital equipment. Gaza's health ministry, for example, has been unable to import medical devices and parts for radiology and imaging services such as CT, PET, and X-ray scanning machines. In 2021, the West Bank Palestinian Authority submitted 120 requests for the entry of such equipment, of which only 30 or 25% were approved by February 2022. Receiving exit permits for medical treatment is therefore critical in Gaza, and time is out of the essence. Ahmad Abu Mustafa, Abdurrahman's father, said that his son needs urgent attention. Among the problems that Abdurrahman faces are a severe lack of oxygen. Ahmad said, "I submitted many requests for the permit but to no avail. I don't know the reason for the delay. I just received a mobile message that the request is under consideration." The Zionist regime often also refuses to allow a minor's parents to accompany them. According to Physicians for Human Rights, in 2021, those rejections reached 35% in 2021. Abdurrahman's parents did not even try to get permits for themselves, and should Abdurrahman be granted an exit permit, he will be accompanied by his grandmother. The head of the International Commission to Support the Rights of the Palestinian People, Salah Abdul Atti, told the Electronic Intifada that the Zionist regime rejects most requests to obtain permits for treatment outside Gaza. The permit regime amounts to torture for Gaza patients. Atti told the Electronic Intifada, especially children for whom anguish about whether they can get treatment is simply added to the physical pain itself. It is also a grave violation of international humanitarian law, specifically the Geneva Conventions, which stipulate a right to medical care, Atti said. He called for serious and effective international intervention to end the siege and put real pressure on the fabricated regime of Israel to ease the suffering of 2 million Palestinians in Gaza.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Cultural news. Social news. Scientific news. Artistic news. With the light.
In this story, we tell you about what could be the bright side of climate change. And that's the discovery of dinosaur tracks dating back to 113 million years ago. The tracks were found in the U.S. state of Texas, where drought has dried up parts of Paluxy River. Experts say the tracks belong to a two-legged dinosaur with small arms and weighing 7 tons. They say dinosaurs made the prints as they roamed muddy areas over 100 million years ago. The prints were then covered over with sediment due to a flood. And after that, they turned into limestone, protecting the prints. The experts say the tracks have not been seen either before or in decades. An aircraft powered by electricity may still be some way off, But one of its types is already here thanks to a whole range of innovative solutions being developed by aviation firms. American company Aviation Aircraft has debuted its all-electric plane in Washington State. The aircraft, named Alice, took off the runway at Grand County International Airport and flew for 8 minutes. It reached an altitude of 3,500 feet before touching down the ground. According to the company, the aircraft produces no carbon emissions, significantly reduces noise, and costs a fraction to operate compared to usual light jets. The company says it continues to develop and tweak the plane's battery system for an hour flight.
We're targeting a design criteria of 35 minutes for a charge. And so that'll be a charge for the typical route length. It's actually, as I just said, it's actually a design point. So going back to the comment I made earlier about designing batteries for aircraft, it's one of the considerations is how quickly do we want it to charge? How much power do you want to be able to draw from it? So again, we're targeting call it 30 minutes of charge for an hour of flight time or about 2C if you're...
The company aims to find its way into the market for trips that sit between 150 and 250 miles, a range that features aircraft similar in size to Alice. It will also be for both commuter and cargo flights. For aircraft manufacturers, this paradigm shift is driving fuel savings in flight and on the ground, reducing carbon footprints and NOx emissions while also improving reliability and cutting maintenance costs. Many people of the world are supported almost completely by animals because they live in areas unsuitable for animal husbandry. But these days, even some city dwellers are making their living out of animals, like a Virginia girl. Andrea Diaz quit her job at a restaurant and started to rent her pet alpacas to cheer up steer crazy Americans during the pandemic. Since the launch of her business in 2020, it has expanded from 2 to 14 alpacas. Interestingly, 5 with fluffy pets are regularly making a paid appearance at birthdays, weddings, restaurants, and offices. She charges a starting price of $95 per hour. Diaz says the best part is when there are kids' birthday parties, but even it's really a fun for the adults. She calls alpacas a good exposure because they attract people.
In most of its habitats, the heavily trafficked pangolin faces the biggest threat from humans. But in Taiwan, these gentle creatures are exposed to quite a different danger, feral dogs. In the island, a government policy has led to a surge in the population of feral dogs. The pangolins share most of their roaming area with the stray animals. Plus, these scaly animals cannot move as fast as their attackers. When faced with danger, pangolins curl themselves into a ball shape. But the tail still remains at the most outer side, and that's where the dogs hit them hard.
Ecuador's Galapagos National Park is testing different coral replanting methods in an effort to restore fragile underwater ecosystems around local islands.
These corals are important because they are recyclers in the ocean. They convert all the CO2 into oxygen. These corals are important because they are refuges, nurseries, and nursery areas for some fish species.
Coral reef die-offs affect the marine food supply chains and are considered a major climate tipping point. The experimental project is run by park rangers and volunteers in a bay on Santa Cruz Island. Since 2020, they have tested how corals reproduce when they are placed on surfaces like bricks, cement, or tied together in strong unmetal frames. They're growing samples in a nursery before adding them to bay. The rangers are reporting improvements with the appearance of new fish near the replanted corals.
A free climber known as the French Spider-Man scales a 48-story skyscraper in Paris to fulfill a goal he set for himself once he reached the age of 60.
A few years back, I promised myself that the day I turn 60, I have to climb the total tower. Because 60 years old marks retirement age in France, and so I thought this would make a very good nod.
Alain Roberts says this building is not as hard as others he has climbed. The French Spider-Man has ascended over 100 of the world's tallest buildings, including the Sydney Tower, the Sears Tower in Chicago, and the Burj Khalifa in Dubai, amongst many others. Roberts says he spent 2 decades climbing mountains before attempting urban climbs. Using his rock climbing experience, he sometimes carries a small bag of climbing chalk to help him grasp the small protrusions of building walls. Many of his climbs can last several hours. The 60-year-old daredevil says he wants to give people the message that age is a number and one can still be active and do sports.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
A Palestinian farmer has discovered an ancient Byzantine-era mosaic when preparing to plant an olive tree on his plot of land in the Gaza Strip. The farmer and his son have been carefully excavating the area for 3 months since spring. The pair dug out 3 patches, revealing glimpses of an ornate mosaic with intricate images of birds, flora, and tile patterns. Its full size is roughly 23 square meters. The discovery has set off excitement amongst archaeologists. Experts say it is one of the most well-preserved specimens with precision in graphics and richness in colors. According to archaeologists, the mosaic pavement dates back to the 5th and 7th centuries. Last month, another Palestinian farmer found the rare stone sculpture while working on his land, which dates back to around 2500 BC. They're back as India has revealed or released several of them into the grasslands of Kuna National Park after a 70-year absence in the country. The 8 radio-coloured African cheetahs made the long journey from Namibia. The big cats were released during a ceremony by Prime Minister Narendra Modi that coincided with his birthday. After their acclimation in the national park, they will be released into a 5-hectare spread of land in central India covered by grassland and forest. The felines will share the landscape with other animals and roam with leopards, sloths, and striped hyenas. Their reintroduction is the culmination of a 13-year effort to restore the species, which vanished from the country decades ago. Another 12 cheetahs are expected to join the fledgling Indian population next month from South Africa. With more funding, the country hopes to gradually increase the population of cheetahs to around 40. World Cleanup Day unites millions of volunteers, governments and organizations to tackle the global waste problem and build a sustainable world. People in several countries joined the efforts again for a waste-free world. Volunteers were seen in mangrove forests in the suburb of Bangkok. They collected more than 1.5 tons of rubbish in just a few hours. Trash picking events were also held in the Philippines and Vietnam. In Hanoi, hundreds, mostly students armed with metal tongs and sacks, walked along major roads. They said their aim is to raise awareness about protecting the environment. In Manila, people cleaned up the city's beaches that are major tourist attractions. The annual cleanup day has been running for over a decade. From divers collecting marine debris to children picking up trash on beaches have just one goal: make our planet a cleaner place.
Chinese astronauts are celebrating their first ever mid-autumn festival in outer space while sharing their otherworldly experience with people on Earth. The crew had a close-up view of the moon from China's Tiangong space station and their third month in space. On the occasion, the ground crew organized a series of celebrations, including a family reunion for the astronauts. The ground crew also prepared elaborate food packages that had been prepared before the launch of the spacecraft. Typically, the traditional festival is kicked off by the first viewing of the full moon on the 15th day of the 8th month of the lunar calendar. Despite being able to see the moon rise and set 16 times a day, the astronauts say the moon is special on this occasion. Forestry authorities in southwestern China have opened a new canteen for wild Asian elephants in a bid to stop them wandering into villages. The canteen in Yunnan province provides the animals with attractive and nutritious meals while exploring man-animal harmonious coexistence. During these years, the province has explored multiple ways to reduce the encounters between humans and elephants and try to keep the animals away from farmers' crops. There are now approximately 1,400 hectares of dining halls for elephants, with many expanding from 100 to 240, such as corn, rice, and sugarcane. They are planted on a large scale and within easy reach of the elephants. The location of such canteens is extremely selective, usually away from villages and major roads, and the chefs are locals. Most of the time, you have to visit an exhibition to see art. But what if art comes to see you instead? Well, a group of artists in Mali have created a floating art venue that will travel up and down the River Niger. It's called the Pirogue du Zem, which is a floating vessel. It's designed to host plays, exhibitions, dance shows, and so much more. The idea is to make art a movable feast that is no longer restricted to fixed venues in cities and accessible to old people. The project was created by a local artist and architect who had a vision to bring art to the masses. The vessel is 20 meters long and 6 meters wide, built with storage and enough space for exhibition. Government officials say the floating venue will showcase Mali's talents and creativity while attracting tourists.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.